the money went. When the next day that the boss is back in the office, she said, "Hey, listen, took care of all that for you." And of course he said, what are you talking about? What, you know, what seven figures did you just send around? How many steps are there? It's really, you got the email, you change your payment. Maybe a bank says, "Do you want to do this?" You say, "Yes, I do." And that's it. Courts are wrestling with who is ultimately responsible. So having coverage counsel in early allows you to step back and say, well, hang on a second, what are they asking for? And what are you describing? Why are you describing it this way? Why are you characterizing it this way? If you do understand that, they'll quickly seize upon and say, well, gosh, thanks for telling us that it's describing it that way. Now that you've described it that way, it means it's not covered. So having coverage counseling early can be helpful.
This is the Cyber Crime Lab, a podcast about true cybercrime stories, the impact on victims, and what businesses can do to protect themselves and their customers. And if you think you're not at risk, that is exactly where attackers want you to be.
In my experience, it only takes hearing what these attacks are like a few times to realize you need to prepare yourself for what could be a business-ending experience.
That's Andy Anderson, the founder and CEO of DataStream Insurance. For over a decade, Andy has been working with victims of cybercrime. He's seen firsthand the human impact of a cyber attack. Now, he's on a mission to shed light on the threats we all face from a world we can't see.
Well, Scott, thanks so much for joining us. For those who don't know you, if you could just, you know, take 30 seconds and introduce yourself, that'd be awesome.
Great. So thanks for having me on. It's Scott Gottes. I am a partner at Barnes & Thornburg, a national law firm, and I am co-chair of our insurance recovery practice, which means I happily help companies when they have problems with insurance and try and convince insurance companies to do the right thing, pay claims, and help people out.
One of the fun things that we've done on this podcast is just get a lot of different perspectives, pulling back the curtain on what happens really after a cyber incident. Unfortunately, most people don't get that. They don't experience that every single day. And so getting a sense of what that looks like. So I know we were talking specifically about one case that was pretty unusual in terms of its length and all of the pieces that you got to see. So why don't we start with that case, and I'll interrupt you along the way.
So this was a fairly early business email compromise matter. And for those people that haven't seen them unfold, what happened was the so-called typical email saying, "Hey, this is your boss." It went to someone in finance, said, "I'm out today. We're doing a transaction. Please be my right-hand person. Keep this discreet. Don't talk with anybody else about it, but I'm going to need you to send some money and help out with the transaction." And you will hear from one of the professionals we're working with on this, and please work with him as we move forward. And he's going to need you to take care of the money to make the transaction go forward. And so the employee thought that the employee was doing the right thing, said, "Okay, boss, you got it. Be super discreet." And then shortly thereafter, the email from the professional advisor came through with the name of a firm from London and had the details. The person in finance did everything that the email said and decided to send seven figures of money as she was instructed to do by both her boss and her boss's advisor.
Just to dig in a little bit, so they're wiring $1 million+. As you dug in, that email that came through, was it actually from their boss's email address, or did it look like their boss's email address? Yeah, walk us through some of the kind of...
It sure looked like it, right? So this was an early enough one that it was not. I mean, later ones that I've dealt with as an insurance person, and sometimes handling them directly, are even more pernicious, where the fraudster or the criminals get access to the account and actually send messages through there. I've seen that where it's even within the same email thread. Someone takes over an entire thread and responds. But this one was an early enough one that it looked like it was from her boss. It was not. And so she prepared the wire with a colleague and went to send the money. The bank said, "Sure, you want to do this? Seems like a lot of money. Seems unusual." And she said, "No, I'm doing everything I was told to do. Boss told me. His advisor told me. So please send the money." So the money went. And when the next day that the boss is back in the office, she said, "Hey, listen, I took care of all that for you." And of course, he said, "What are you talking about? What, you know, what seven figures did you just send around?
$1 million+, right? Yeah.
Yes.
And how big an organization is this? How does $1 million stack up? $1 million is $1 million for anybody, but like,
yeah, this was a growing organization. This hurt. This was not a multi-billion-dollar enterprise where $1 million is kind of a rounding error by any means. This hurt. It didn't bankrupt them, but it was very unpleasant. And again, like this is not a slam on them by any means. And we can all Monday morning quarterback and everyone wants to, oh, well, if they had only, and why didn't they? And these scams happen all the time because people go for them. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry for criminals. Tens of billions of dollars have been lost. From my perspective, again, that's a direct loss. How many steps are in between? If it's the situation where you get the email, you send the wire, even if the bank steps in, from my perspective, that's direct. It's not 1,000 steps removed. It's not a month later. It's not multiple different days or transactions, whatever it is. The carrier, say, makes it indirect. It's pretty straightforward. As an aside, to take us down a slightly different path, the industry has tried to make changes to their policies to address that situation.
When you file a cyber attack claim with insurance agencies, you must indicate whether it was a direct or indirect attack. Indirect attacks involve many layers of different types of cybercrime, while direct attacks are more direct and target the victim to gain immediate access to funds. Direct attacks can often lead to indirect attacks. When working with cyber insurance companies, this type of specification is essential.
It's still, from my perspective, computer fraud, and with the right language and a policy, funds transfer fraud, because they've since argued or sought permission to change their policies. From my perspective, it's direct. But if you get an email that says, change payment and details, and send it by wire to this bank rather than the bank you were using previously, how many steps are there? It's really, you got the email, you change your payment, maybe a bank says, do you want to do this? You say, yes, I do, and that's it. Whereas the other case I was talking about where it was indirect, it was people were able to double load credits onto and tokens onto an account and then over withdraw from the account, right? So like you had a debit card and they were falsely overloading it. So that's saying, okay, it's worth $100 rather than $50. And then it was a question of, if they withdrew the 100 rather than the 50, when was the loss actually sustained by the financial institution that loaded it up? And did they have time to stop it? And how many steps were there involved? Now, I still thought it was a direct loss situation, but the court said there were too many steps, right? You had a chance to stop it when there was the overloading. You had a chance to stop it when you found out about the scheme overall. There were hundreds and hundreds of transactions over a period of time. So they said that's too far removed. But an email that says, hey, change payment, and you change payment, why is that suddenly the chain gets broken? And I think the right decision is that it's direct.
Yeah. And help me, because I know that this is another issue, and we'll get back to the story. We got one story, but a fun bunch of other stories going on. So this piece about, let's say the invoice, it came from the real, they've compromised the email of the vendor. And so the vendor is sending what looks to be a like really legitimate email from their right email address, blah, blah, blah. Who's liable there? Is it the company that paid or is it the company that was owed, but it was sort of their mistake?
So you just asked a multi-million dollar question. And because courts are wrestling with who is ultimately responsible. And there have been just a handful of decisions dealing with exactly this. For example, there's one out of the Sixth Circuit, Ohio, Michigan, and some other states, where there were competing auto dealerships. And one dealership said, hey, send me a bunch of big SUVs. And the other one said, hey, sure, send you a bunch of big SUVs. And lo and behold, and then the payment was, oh, send it by wire. Don't send it by check, and et cetera. And the emails had been hacked. The payment never actually got to the selling dealer, whereas the buying dealer got the SUVs. So now what? Who's to blame there? And the trial court picked one party, said, you're to blame. And then the Court of Appeals said, no, we really want to understand which of these two parties both had the last clear chance to fix it and which of them was more responsible and which had bigger failures. in terms of failing to catch it. And the two things they tend to look at is, how did this happen? One of them got hacked, maybe both of them got hacked in that case, and allowed the fraudster to get in and take over the emails and send out fraudulent emails. So was it the party that got hacked for having let its guard down one time and the hackers got in and took over the emails? Or was it the party that received the fraudulent email and the Monday morning quarterback? So he said, well, why didn't you just pick up the phone and make a phone call? It's like, well, literally all the business I do is via email and online. So why would I do that?
This seems big, but we do 50 of these a day.
Yeah. But the track record in terms of success there, unless, again, like you say, well, hey, listen, a whole new thing came to light, a whole new case, a whole new series of facts came to light. But no, they didn't have any of that. They just said, we think you got it wrong. So they appealed it. And then there was some craziness about in the appeal of, well, are we even supposed to be in federal court? And in just terms of the ownership of the company, it was back and forth and a bunch of briefing about that. They would only excite lawyers. You know, same kind of arguments, whether the loss was direct or not. They said direct means direct, which it's like saying blue is blue. They said that must mean that there's only one step. You get the email and you send the money out, if that lined up with what the language meant. They said that's not even what the language means and didn't really explain how things would work in that circumstance. So they went to their insurance carriers. Cyber insurance carrier thought that they didn't need to cover the cost of investigation because they thought that there was actually no quote unquote breach of the system where personally identifying information was compromised. So they didn't want to pay that. So that was the cyber carrier. The crime carrier said that they didn't have to pay either, but they didn't say that at first. And that's the tough part. What they did at first, they said, oh, we've actually brought in a lawyer to help us investigate the claim. And the claim adjuster was a lawyer, so not an unsophisticated party. Brought in his former boss from an outside law firm that represents carriers in coverage matters. And so they said that they were investigating, they were trying to check this out, they would get the policy and figure out whether it was covered. And so the client gave the information that they were asked for. So a little bit of time went by and lo and behold, a letter came in and said, you're not covered. We don't have to cover this. So I got brought in.
You know, looking at a lot of the policies, that the cyber policy often includes a crime element. You know, it's usually sublimited. But in this case, it was a separate crime policy, but it included...
Right. Standalone crime policy that included coverage for computer fraud and funds transfer fraud. When I read the funds transfer fraud, the three different definitions, the third one jumped off the page at me and talked about a fraudulent instruction received by you, then passed along to the bank, that results in money being sent out. So I thought, okay, well, this was a fraudulent instruction received by the policyholder, then it went to the bank. I don't understand what else this is written for. What else was this supposed to cover? But the carrier said no. The carrier said that the loss was not direct, that there were too many steps in between the original message and the actual wiring of the funds, even though this took place in somewhere under 2 hours.
It can often seem difficult to understand which sort of incident insurance will cover, which is exactly where lawyers like Scott come in. As Scott will explain, it's always better to contact your trusted lawyer as soon as you can. The earlier you can get coverage counsel, the better.
So who uses the phone anymore, right? I mean, like that's the big running joke. Like, I must really love you if you call me as opposed to text me. But the Monday morning quarterbacking always says, why didn't you make a phone call? And so the court ultimately said, it's the party that had the chance to, was best able to stop this from happening. And they sent it back to the trial court to have a trial over which one of the two parties was the one that could have stopped things. I haven't seen further decisions as a result. So you say, who's ultimately responsible? And there are certainly arguments. And some other decisions say, hey, if you got the stuff and yet the seller never received payment, that's a breach of contract. So the company makes the two different claims and the crime carrier says, okay, we're investigating it. They hire lawyers to quote unquote help them. Help them do what? As the story unfolds, you'll have questions. And they send a letter back saying, you're not covered. It's not direct loss, among other things. But that's the primary argument. So we write back and tell them, you're all wet. This is covered. You should pay. And they say no. So now what?
And because this is like, for someone who does this, when should they think about getting you involved? And when do you typically get involved, right? Because one of the things is to arm our listeners with kind of like understanding this world.
Yeah. So this will sound super self-promotional, but the earlier you get coverage counsel involved, unfortunately, the better. And the reason being that there are words, phrases, and synonyms that can trip someone up. So for example, if you were dealing with a circumstance where you had a payment card breach from way back in the day, like 2013 timeframe, these came around a lot. And people said, oh, well, yeah, we had an event and we owe fines and penalties to the card brands of this many millions of dollars. And the carrier cleverly says, oh, fines and penalties. Well, gosh, look at that. Fines and penalties are not covered, or they're covered at 10% of the policy limit. If you said, well, hang on a second, actually what we meant by what we owe is we owe the cost of replacing cards and for satisfying and resolving fraudulent charges, assessments by the card brands passed through the processor. Well, those aren't excluded. And so if you use the terms that everyone uses in regular everyday life, maybe you unfortunately use the wrong terminology, the wrong synonym, and the carrier says no.
Words and language matter, especially in the world of insurance. As Scott mentions, if you use everyday language, you could end up putting yourself in a position where you won't get covered. Experts like Scott know exactly the right terminology to use. Just one more reason why to enlist the help of a professional.
Another one I have in mind where there was, again, a business email compromise, was actually a takeover of an account. And how then do you frame it? If you talk all about social engineering as like the old-fashioned ones, where it just is a spoofed email without actually attacking or getting into the system, the carrier will say, well, okay, social engineering fraud coverage, again, you get 1/10 of the policy limit. If you say, well, what actually happened based upon our investigation is that somebody broke into our system, took over an email account, or broke into the other party's system and took over an email account, sent us fraudulent emails as a result of having control of the system, that sounds a lot more like computer fraud. You're telling exactly what happened. You're telling 100% the truth, but you're being mindful of how do you describe the truth? There's no description. This is literally exactly what happened.
Yeah. Words matter, right?
But words matter, right? Exactly. For this, the carrier says, well, it's a contract and the contract says what it says. And if you come in and say, well, we had a loss due to a social engineering fraud event. We want coverage. You'll get a certain limit. But if you come in and say there was an attack on the computer system, the hackers took over the account, sent a fraudulent email, and there was fraud as a result of that, you have exactly described, you have given just the facts, ma'am. You have not changed anything. You have told them exactly what happened. And you've been 100% truthful. And lo and behold, that's what computer fraud coverage, I think anyone would admit, okay, that's what that's designed to cover. So having coverage counsel in early allows you to step back and say, well, hang on a second, what are they asking for? And what are you describing? Why are you describing it this way? Why are you characterizing it this way? If you do understand that, they'll quickly seize upon it and say, well, gosh, thanks for describing it that way. Now that you've described it that way, it means it's not covered. So having coverage counsel in early can be helpful. And I get that people say, well, I bought these products and was told to cover anything cyber and computer related. Why do I need to do that? Again, most of the time you probably don't, but for things like this, you'd be better off if you did.
Yeah. You know, we talk about needing experts, right? And that's why, you know, we focus here and I'm blown away by it's a lot of folks end up buying these policies and they sort of just, they don't read them. You know, even the people who are selling them to them don't really understand what they're selling. And so, you know, you can really get yourself in a lot of trouble. That mismatch of expectations and reality is never fun. Well, anyways, okay, so they hire this lawyer and they start investigating. Let's keep going.
The claim adjuster sends a letter back saying it's not covered and say, okay, well, now what do we do? They've refused to pay. Clients out 7 figures of money. We write a letter back saying, here's why we think you're wrong. And they still say, well, too bad. So we file suit. We file it in state court. The insurance company says, I don't want to be in state court. I would have to be in federal court. They think they'll have a better shot in federal court. So they pull us in there.
And you can do that when it's like over state lines, basically? That's what allows you to go federal?
It can be even within the same state lines, as long as it's more than $75,000 in dispute and the parties are all from different jurisdictions. You can't all be from the same state. So we file a complaint. They file an answer. They say we're all wrong. And we say, okay, we'd like some discovery of your files, which is what happens in litigation. You get to see the files. And they said, we don't have anything to turn over to you because we hired lawyers right from the beginning to help us. Here is where it gets fun, but also nerdy because I can't help myself. When an insurance company hires a lawyer to investigate and handle the claim, the rule is supposed to be those files are still discoverable. Because an insurance company is not supposed to say for every workaday claim, we'll hire a lawyer and therefore protect our files from discovery.
Right. Because for those, work with a lawyer is at least broadly has the attorney-client privilege.
Yeah, generally speaking. But an insurance company's ordinary course of business, its ordinary business is handling claims. And so it cannot be that you get to hire a lawyer for every single claim and never, ever turn over your files. So I said, well, hang on. How is it that when you emailed and said, we engaged these lawyers to help us investigate the claim? And I said, if it's investigation, that's discoverable. And they said, no, it's privilege. So then from minute one, before you even saw the insurance policy, you already decided there was no coverage. Is that good faith? And so we were at loggerheads where it was, you know, I had them where it was said, okay, if you say that the lawyer was investigating, then you have to give me your files. If you say the lawyer was there as a lawyer and it's privileged, then you'd already denied coverage and you weren't acting in good faith when you said that you were investigating and trying to figure things out. We ended up winning a ruling from the judge on the merits saying it's covered before we resolved that dispute. So it just got left to hang. I'll take the ruling on the merits any day of the week. I think it was something crazy where it was like, if the bank got a note that you would hand it to them, that because someone handed you a note and you hand it to the bank, then that's exactly the kind of thing this was designed to cover. But come on. And the court agreed to have oral argument. We had oral argument in front of three federal appellate judges. They questioned us quite a bit. And a few months later, they ruled in our favor and said that, yeah. Two of the judges said, it's so clearly covered that it's clear and it's unambiguously covered. One judge said, well, I think it's ambiguous as to whether the bank and its efforts would make it indirect or no longer be direct loss. So I would have a hearing on that. We didn't lose on it. It was his opinion, but 2-1. Two, slam dunk, yes. One, maybe yes, maybe no. I think we should have more on it. But two is all we needed. And it's a published decision. So
all these steps, I mean, just so unusual for things to go that long. How long did this take? Couple years or?
Couple years, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. And then eventually you ended up settling, right?
So yeah, so they said, we're going to ask for the entire slate of judges on that court of appeals to rule on it. They call it en banc. Every single judge would hear it. We think that we could do that, and et cetera. And so we said, okay, let's stop. can we just like put this to bed and resolve it?
We're going to eat up all this money just in the lawyer
fees.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's remarkable that one word or one phrase, direct loss or loss resulting directly or just direct, can have a lot of different meanings, which really means it's ambiguous. There's more than one meaning. Direct loss came around. Some insurance carriers have argued that it came around to distinguish between when it's your own money versus when it is your liability to a third party. And there's a phrase from a case, say, direct means direct, which actually tells you nothing. It's like saying blue is blue. What does that mean? Well, the rest of that case talks about the fact that it's a third-party liability, there's a demand against you, that is not direct, that's indirect, because it's a liability policy question. So that's, some states say that. Now, some states say it has to be within the causal chain or proximate cause, or lawyer phraseology. And it means how many steps removed is it foreseeable this would happen? And so, for example, there was one that involved, it was Retail Ventures, which is the parent company of DSW Shoes, had a data breach back in the day or a cyber attack back in the day. And there was a demand from the card brand saying you owe us multiple millions as a result of this event. And the carrier said, well, your loss and your money is owed to the card brands through the processor. That's not direct loss. And the court said, no, it's close enough. You had the event, you knew you had these liabilities, and that's close enough for direct. So where we were, there was another case going on at the same time. And that case resulted in a couple of decisions saying that direct was not satisfied. There were too many steps in between in terms of how the cyber attack happened or the attack happened, and then the loss actually was suffered. They've since brought out social engineering fraud endorsements, invariably at a lower policy limit. And I've got a story about that too. And they'll try and steer you to either say it's not direct loss, or if there's social engineering, they'll say it's there because the policy limit for social engineering is, again, invariably a sliver of the total policy limit. So like, for example, you might have bought a $3 million policy, but only $100,000 of coverage for social engineering.
So your reading is that it is a direct loss or it is an indirect loss because you owe the money, but well, so just clarify that point.
Now you could argue, well, hang on a second, that might be true, but was the seller negligent in terms of letting themselves get hacked and resulting in me sending the money to a fraudster? It remains to be seen. The law is remarkably murky in this space.
Yeah. And breach of contract, for those who that doesn't trigger thinking, that's typically not covered in most of these policies, right?
So you can certainly expect carriers to say, hey, here's a contract-based exclusion. But from my perspective, there are other questions, right? Which is this a cyber attack-based issue? And is there an argument that this is due to cybersecurity, even if one of the remedies would be breach of contract? Would there be a common law remedy? This is super nerdy insurance stuff.
Nerdy insurance stuff is just the way we like it. In all seriousness, Scott is clearly working hard to make sure that cyber insurance companies act right to their customers, which is, for us, the most important aspect of working in this industry. As frustrating as it might be that this idea isn't universal, that's exactly why we need experts like Scott and his law firm.
There are claims, for example, if you could say, hey, even without the contract, I'd be liable, then the breach of contract exclusion not supposed to apply. Because I get a carrier saying, hey, listen, I don't want to be a guarantor of your business. You say, I'll sell you 100 widgets and you get the money. You don't give them the widgets. You can't turn to the insurance carrier and say, well, now pay for that. Or vice versa. You're out the money due to just a regular old business transaction. I understand that. If it's a cybersecurity-based problem resulting something, and the way that they assert it is the easiest way is to say, hey, this is a contract problem.
Yeah, interesting. And I guess my last question is there any sense of, like in auto and different states have different levels of liability, sort of like, are you more than some? It's like you have to be 100% responsible, and some they decide you're 20% responsible. Is there any breakdown of that in these disputes and in these contracts?
Yeah. So if it comes down to negligence and it's the regular old negligence standard, you would have comparative versus contributory, right? Where one of them says, if you're any percent at fault at all, then your negligence claim fails. Whereas other states, they look at the percentages and they reduce the liability of the defendant based upon the shared negligence. So if it's a 20-80 split, say, well, okay, you can recover, but you only will get 80% of the recovery because you were 20% at fault. But it's state dependent.
And that's just, some states are in camp one and some states are in camp two. What's the breakdown?
So it's been a while since I've had to look at it kind of at a national level. The story from back in the day when I was learning all this for the bar exam was that it started out by saying if you are negligent at all, you are not able to recover is the older way. Then in the 60s, probably with California, started saying, well, that's not fair. You should be able to recover, but with a reduction based upon your own percentage of fault.
Yeah. Have we seen that? That's true in cyber as well.
So I haven't seen a court come out to say, take it all the way through and say, okay, we had a full trial and we determined here are the percentages of negligence. And because under our state law, if you're 1%, you don't recover, or if you're 20%, I haven't seen them take it that far. But I would anticipate that if negligence was the way that you're moving forward, then they would apply the old fashioned rule and say, well, here's how we're going to evaluate this.
Why did the judge say that? I mean, when you say it's a ruling on merit, what does that mean?
So you can go to the court. The ordinary course of a case would be you file a complaint, they file an answer, there's discovery, get to see each other's files, you can take depositions, you can do other things. But you can also move for summary judgment saying, hey, take a look at what's being seen, what we have so far. We think the policy clearly provides coverage, or at a minimum, it's ambiguous and therefore it covers. And they said, oh, well.
Right, because in a dispute between an insurance company and a claimant, because the contract is written by the insurance carrier, like ambiguity goes to the company, not the insurance carrier.
So being a good buyer means working with a sophisticated broker to start and talking with your broker and saying, this is what I want, and talking through and what are the options? Because the other problem is this is not the kind of contract like any other kind of contract where you can sit down with the party on the other side and start writing an agreement together and working through it together. This is, here's what the insurance industry is offering. And a sophisticated broker will come in and say, here's what the industry is offering. Here are the options for what you can get for cyber risks today, whether it's coverage in a cyber policy for ransomware or kidnap ransom extortion policy for ransomware as overlapping coverage, whether it's coverage in a crime policy for these sorts of risks or overlapping with cyber, talking through what's being offered. And there are many, many insurers that say that they offer a, they've built a better mousetrap and that their offerings include, that their policy includes coverage that others don't. And talking about that and talking about where the limitations are and what they are requiring. And talking about, for example, okay, well, this policy does include coverage for computer fraud, funds transfer fraud, social engineering fraud, invoice manipulation fraud, or it doesn't. And if it does, how much does it include? So another example I have is, you know this, Andy, the carrier says, here's our offer letter. Here's what we would offer you. And they maybe even say the binder letter. And both of those just say the policy type, the policy limits, the premium, and maybe it lists 7 or 8 names of endorsements. So like, for example, if you got a letter that said, here is your policy that includes cyber and crime, that doesn't actually include the policy, just says, here's the binder for it, because you don't get the policy for months afterwards. And listed within that multi-million dollar policy says social engineering fraud, who would think that what that ultimately means is $100,000 of coverage with a significantly higher deductible in a multi-million dollar policy? Because it doesn't say social engineering fraud limitation, just says social engineering fraud. And the insurance industry very cleverly says, oh, we've sold you coverage for social engineering fraud. And everybody else says, wait a minute, I thought that was included in computer and funds transfer fraud coverage. No. That wasn't our intent. So now we've added it in, but they've only added in a sliver.
Again, language is everything. This is true across auto, home, life, and cyber. It's important to pay attention and stay vigilant when reviewing your coverage. As Scott will explain, the best cyber policies feature the most explicit language.
What we try and do is shove some and really look hard at sublimits.
Yeah. Super important. Right.
Yeah. I guess the last piece before we let you go is, have you seen changes in wording in policies? And my view is always like, better to have it be explicitly listed than assume that it's there. Because again, we can lean on that ambiguity, but we're going to have a discussion. Whereas if the language is there, you're at least moving towards clarity.
So again, better cyber policies, because there's no standardization, better cyber policies include more things explicitly. They didn't used to be coverage for ransomware and cyber extortion, didn't used to include coverage for business interruption, didn't used to include coverage for business interruption caused by system failure as opposed to cyber attack, didn't used to include coverage for reputational harm without a system interruption, business interruption. So these things are included now that didn't used to be included for better carriers, better policies. Some carriers are including some forms of social engineering fraud explicitly, some carriers and some limits, but those are things that are changes. I have been at conferences where cyber underwriters say, oh gosh, things like computer fraud or BECs and wire transfer and business email compromise, those are really left to crime underwriters. Those are crimes. It's like, well, are you saying a cyber attack's not a crime? I mean, but so be it. That's how they wanted to distinguish it. That's how they viewed their world. They viewed their world of dealing with notifications and defending class actions, but not things along those lines.
Yeah. The devil's in the details and words matter. I think the two big things that I would take away
it's
from
that
this.
And it's, you know, the final point on that is paying attention to what the carrier says when they've sent the letter. Invariably, the letter that comes out after the, it should be a first letter saying, oh, we're taking a look at this, we'll get back to you. Then the next one will say, okay, so we've gotten your matter and we're evaluating coverage. And ideally it says, we're pleased to let you know that coverage is triggered by what's taken place. And here's the coverages that you'll get. And then again, invariably there'll be 8 single space pages citing a bunch of different policy limitations, clauses, exclusions, et cetera. And it's called a reservation of rights letter. And people put it in a drawer, don't think anything of it. What that means is we, the insurance carrier, are reserving the right to deny coverage later if we decide that there's something that's come about that is within an exclusion. So it's easy to get excited, as you rightfully should, the carrier saying, hey, coverage is triggered and here's the coverages that will apply. But it's challenging to recall what the carrier is saying could open a trap door underneath you.
And that's the point where maybe, you know, pick up the phone and have a chat with you. And
yeah, right. With a lawyer who knows what he or she is doing in the space and can see it and understand and address it and say, look, here are things that you need to keep in mind. And also here's what that means as to how things go forward. If a carrier has made it so that they say, well, okay, here are 12 things that would allow us to deny coverage, but lucky for you, there's one little sliver of something that implicates coverage. What does it mean in terms of reporting? What does it mean in terms of rights to independent counsel? Other things along those lines.
Yeah. So it sounds like pick up the phone and chat with you sooner, like you said, sooner rather than later. This is great. I really appreciate the time, perspective. Someone who's becoming more of a cyber insurance nerd every day. It's fun to talk with someone who's been doing it for a long time. If people want to get a hold of you, what's the best way to do it?
It's by email. My email address will be in the show notes, hopefully, but it's scott.goddess@btlaw.com. Again, it's Barnes and Thornburg. That's the best way to get in touch with me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Cyber Crime Lab, brought to you by Datastream Insurance. When the worst happens, you're going to want the best financial, legal, and technical support to get you back up and running again. With cyber insurance from Datastream, we find the most comprehensive insurance coverage on the market alongside critical post-incident customer support. Go to datastreaminsurance.com today and see how we can help you secure your business data. That's datastreaminsurance.com. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe and give us a 5-star review. You'll find show notes and any resources mentioned at cybercrimelabpodcast.com. We hope you'll join us next episode. Until then, stay safe. More importantly, stay ready.